Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Monday, the 6th of July. Today, Barack Obama heads for Moscow. He hopes to restart America's relationship with Russia, a difficult task.
The real power broker in Russia, everyone knows, is Putin. And Putin is an altogether more obdurate, more prickly, more difficult figure.
Also today, calls for an inquiry into how information about the personal life of the new head of MI6 was posted on Facebook by his wife. And Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon.
Always being introduced as the second man on the moon, that is a degrading title right off the bat, instead of being a member of the first landing mission to reach the moon.
Sorry about that, Buzz. First, here's a man with his feet firmly on the ground, Bill Overton, with the news and today's papers.
Barack Obama is in Moscow today for a summit with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Nuclear arms will be at the top of the agenda. However, there have been deep divisions between the two countries over defence in recent years. Russia's said there can be no agreement unless the US is prepared to heed its concerns on missile defence. More of this later in Guardian Daily from our correspondent in Russia. The ousted Honduran president Manuel Zelaya has failed to fly back to his country after soldiers blocked the runway. At least two people were killed as troops fended off Zelaya supporters converging on the airport. He was ousted a week ago and has landed in neighbouring El Salvador instead. David Cameron's to pledge to cut the number of quangos to save money and increase accountability. The Tory leader will ask shadow cabinet ministers to identify which bodies within their areas should go, with an aim to cut 790 of them, which currently costs £35 billion a year. Leaders of the G8 nations will meet on Wednesday for 3 days of talks on the world economy, climate change and aid. On the table will be targets to cut greenhouse gases by 80% by 2050 and warnings by Gordon Brown that international complacency is in danger of bringing economic recovery to a halt and plunging the world into a second recession. Roger Federer became the first man to win 15 Grand Slam singles titles when he won Wimbledon yesterday. In a marathon match, he beat Andy Roddick in a game that went to 16-14 in the fifth set. A quick look at this morning's papers now, and almost all carry pictures of Roger Federer with his Wimbledon trophy. He's the greatest, says The Express. The Guardian leads with the story that British former Guantanamo detainee Binyam Mohamed has begun legal moves to stop US courts destroying evidence which he claims proves he was tortured. The Independent reports city accountants are advising bankers on how to avoid paying the 50p tax rate. The Telegraph claims police are spending more time filling out forms despite government efforts to cut red tape. And The Times says NHS patients will be able to transfer their medical notes to private companies like Google under a Tory government. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
President Barack Obama visits Moscow today. He'll be discussing ways of reducing nuclear weapons and of improving cooperation over Afghanistan. But there are deep divisions over US missile defence, NATO expansion, and last year's Russian invasion of Georgia. Luke Harding's in Moscow for The Guardian. He says there's a mountain to climb.
Yes, it's a bit like going up Mount Everest without an oxygen tank, I have to say. Personally, I'm very gloomy that this summit is really going to achieve anything very much. If we scroll back a few months, really relations between Moscow and Washington under George Bush were as bad as they've been since the early 1980s and the Cold War. Things were really very terrible. And Obama, who's making his first trip to Russia today as US president, has said that he wants to reset relations with the Kremlin and basically enjoy a kind of better relationship and better dialogue. But the problem is the problems between them seem intractable, not least over the kind of thorny issue of nuclear arms reduction.
A nuclear-free planet is one of Obama's long-term goals.
Yes, that's right. We have to bear in mind that the United States and Russia between them have more than 90% of the world's nuclear missiles. And in theory, it would seem kind of relatively easy to get a deal. But the problem is missile defense in Central Europe. Now, this was a plan by the Bush administration to have radar interceptors and missile defense shields in Poland and the Czech Republic. And Obama, while I think he's cooler on this than Bush was, has not agreed to dump it. Now, the Russians want him to get rid of it, and they say that only unless he gets rid of it can there be a new deal. Now, yesterday, Sunday, he told Novaya Gazeta, the Russian opposition newspaper, he wasn't prepared to do this. So while I think there's going to be a lot of warm rhetoric today and tomorrow with Obama in Moscow, I think really the summit is careering towards failure.
And Obama described Putin, the Prime Minister and former Russian President, of course, as a man with one foot in the Cold War era.
Yes, I thought that was most extraordinary, not least because Obama really kind of hit the nail on the head. Putin is someone very much his mindset dates back from his time in the KGB. And really, he still sees relations with America through this kind of adversarial prism of the Cold War. But for Obama to say this 2 days before he flies into Moscow, I thought was surprisingly either honest or undiplomatic, depending on your point of view. But Obama is having several hours today talking to Medvedev and a press conference later on in the Kremlin. But really, the key encounter will be tomorrow, Tuesday, when he has breakfast with Putin. And I think that'll be an extremely interesting encounter indeed. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Putin says something rather inflammatory afterwards.
And what about relations between Medvedev, the Russian president, and Obama?
If you want to be cynical about this, Medvedev is kind of the salesman. He's the nice, smiley guy who wears a baseball hat and says, friendly things towards the West, encourages Western investment, and will be smiling and joking with Obama later on today when they appear jointly together. But the problem is the real power broker in Russia, everyone knows, is Putin. And Putin is an altogether more obdurate, more prickly, more difficult figure. And Putin is the one who kind of is the supreme arbiter of Russian foreign policy. And this has been the problem all along, that Medvedev is the main interlocutor for Obama, but he's not the guy who makes the decisions at the end of the day. So if anything actually genuinely kind of positive, concrete comes out of this, I'll be astonished. And John, you can buy me a vodka.
All right, Luke, it's a deal. Many thanks. And there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Russia. Also on The Guardian's website today, John Henley meets Britain's youngest undertaker. That's at guardian.co.uk/G2. Irwin James, he's a former prisoner, and he writes about Jack Straw's decision to refuse parole to the great train robber Ronnie Biggs. That's at guardian.co.uk/prisons. And we ask, can artists save the planet? We look at awareness of environmental issues in the arts at guardian.co.uk/arts. When Sir John Soares took over as head of MI6 last month, it's safe to assume he didn't expect to hit the headlines in quite the way he did yesterday. Sir John's wife, Lady Shelley Soares, disclosed various details about their family life on Facebook, accessible to all of the social networking site's 200 million users. Result? Uproar in the Mail on Sunday. James Stirk has the details.
The wife of the British Ambassador to the United Nations, John Soares, who is about to become the new head of MI6, put up a series of photographs of family holidays and other events on Facebook, which showed our ambassador on a beach playing frisbee and with friends. In one picture, he's wearing a Santa's hat at Christmas from a couple of years ago.
And some of this material was posted after the announcement that he was to become the new head of MI6.
He was appointed, or at least the appointment was published, middle of June, and according to the Mail on Sunday, many of these photos went up on that day or the day after, which I suppose leads you to suggest that the family hadn't been briefed properly by the Foreign Office about what their policy was on social network sites.
What is the Foreign Office policy?
They're warned about images and blog posts and so on that they might put on sites such as Facebook. And I understand that MI6 are meant to be far tighter in what they put out into public domain.
I mean, what are the security implications of this? I mean, the chairman of the counter-terrorism subcommittee, the Conservative MP Patrick Mercer, says that the MI6 chief has left himself open to blackmail.
It all sounds very serious, doesn't it? I mean, the newspaper suggested that he could potentially leave himself up to compromise, and they were revealing details of where the family lives, and clearly you could see how that potentially could lead to problems. But it would also seem that much of the information would have been, if not in the public domain already, could have been found out very easily by someone doing an online search, or even looking who's who. And I think it's not so much that these are open to blackmail, but just open to allegations of being a bit silly.
I mean, the Foreign Secretary David Miliband and other politicians, the former Prime Minister Sir John Major, basically said this whole thing's being overblown. It's just a few pictures of him in his swimming trunks. But the Liberal Democrats want an inquiry. Any chance of that, do you think?
Well, they're standing by it. They've been asked again today whether they want an inquiry, and now Vince Cable is insisting that they do. I think it's not something which is going to particularly reveal a great deal, other than maybe he has Calvin Klein underwear or something.
James Stirk. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, Chris Anderson, author of The Long Tail, on the proliferation of free things in the digital age.
Free as in liberty, freedom, free as in no price. And then free has this different economic meaning as well, which is sort of a trick, a marketing trick. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
But first, back in January, after Israel's three-week war with Hamas, The Observer's Peter Beaumont went to Gaza. He met Palestinians devastated by the deaths of loved ones and the destruction of their homes. 6 months later, he returned to find they're still waiting to rebuild their homes and their lives.
In January, The Observer encountered three women and their families. 6 months later, I returned to Gaza to see what had changed in their lives and what had happened to Gaza. For Gaza itself, still under a punishing Israeli blockade that will not allow even cement or other building materials into the strip for reconstruction, the answer is that little has altered. For the individuals, the story is more complex. I found Shifa Salman, a 20-year-old student, living in the ruins of her home with other members of her family. I'm shocked to find that for Shifa, little has changed since we first met. She has moved with her family from the ruins of the house itself to a shack in the open behind her home without electricity or running water. She's back at university now, where she's studying to be a teacher, but admits that she is struggling with her studies.
Life before the war was lovely, but now everything has changed. There is no beauty now. When the Israeli jets fly over, I die of fear. Even the drones make me feel scared. When I hear gunfire, I am scared. I'm 20 and I feel like this. It makes me wonder what it must be like for the children. I can't take it. I remember how my neighborhood used to be when I walk around it. It used to be green. There were homes still standing. There were people walking. Now, there is no one, just broken houses, bulldozed land. There are only dogs, and when I see them, I am frightened. Now, after the war, I am forced to study in a shack without a table. No electricity at night. I have to study in the daytime, so I can see.
Rawa Omar I met for the first time in a hospital in Khan Yunis, by the beds of Ola and Yahya, her children, wounded in a strike by an Israeli drone after the ceasefire.
Yes, I'm very worried. And I hope that they will have a better life than they have now. I hope everything changes. No, in the last 10 years, it's never became better. And it's became more worse than before. There is no rebuilding or anything like that.
Rawa Omar is one of the luckier ones. Her children's physical wounds at least have healed, although they are still psychologically damaged. The most tragic case I come across is that of 16-year-old Sana, who was trapped for days with the corpses of her family members. When I first met her, she was desperately withdrawn. Her counsellor said she had lost the will to live. 6 months on, she appears overwhelmed still by the grief and the horror of what has happened to her.
I don't enjoy studying anymore. I went to see the nurse because people kept asking me questions at school about what happened. They asked, why weren't you wounded? Why was it them that died, not you? Why did they target you? Questions like these, they really upset me.
Peter Beaumont reporting. 40 years ago, Buzz Aldrin flew to the moon as part of the Apollo 11 mission. But after returning to Earth, he had a tough time, suffering depression, the collapse of two marriages and alcoholism. The Guardian's Stephen Moss asked him if he recognised himself as the same man who walked on the moon.
Yes, it was an awesome responsibility.
I read different things about whether it bothered you that you were the second person.
Yeah.
Some people say it bothers you, some people say it doesn't bother you.
Well, we're dealing with very competitive people who always want to get the most out of the opportunities that come along. Even though I did not relish the idea of many speeches and celebrations and being on a pedestal as a hero. I didn't enter the space program to want to do that. And certainly being first outside the spacecraft would bring much, much more responsibility. I really wasn't looking for that sort of thing.
So it didn't bother you particularly?
I wouldn't say that. It's continually being asked, didn't it bother you that you were second? And then always being introduced as the second man on the moon? That is a degrading title right off the bat, instead of being a member of the first landing mission to reach the moon.
And then afterwards, the whole breakdown, you attribute to losing the discipline of being in the...
Losing the structure, losing the...
And the goal, once you'd achieved the goal, you didn't know what you were aiming for, presumably.
Right. I had in mind a career in the Air Force, but very nebulous ways that might take. I had been in squadron level at the flight commander position, not at squadron ops. I'd experienced those things, but now I'm virtually at the fringes of general officer rank, and I've missed 11 years. What is it going to be as I try and renew my Air Force career? And it was disappointing that did not work. It just appeared that was not a pathway that I wanted to continue to pursue.
And then the 70s were almost a lost decade for you, weren't they? I mean, they were lost in...
Yes, it really was.
To the booms and the depression and the almost a complete breakdown in a way.
But I got remarried, and that didn't work out at all. Yep. But then I attained a successful sobriety, and I've been able to continue that with distinct attention, and it wasn't long before describing that in a way was not the journey to the moon, it was return to Earth. Clearly, that was the challenging part. How do I achieve something like that and then come back and readjust?
The essence of the problem
was... And I was not all that successful in my control, my decisions of readjustment that led to further discouragement and lack of structure, lack of guidance, and...
I don't know whether this is your phrase.
Just things came apart.
What does a man do for an encore after walking on the moon?
No, it's a descriptive what comes next.
Yeah, but that was the problem. Yeah, you'd walked on the moon at 39. How do you follow that?
You're describing just an average person, and you'd say in that sort of thing, geez, he just wasn't up to it. He had weaknesses. I inherited tendencies in different directions. And those directions, if you inherit them and you feed them in some way with a life of perfection and discipline and achievement, and then remove that all of a sudden, it's probably going to go back to some of the more deep-seated concerns about self-worth and real achievement. Now, you did that as a part of a team. What are you doing now? Yeah. So what does that do to a person's ego?
Okay. And last thing, what's it like to have Buzz Lightyear named after you? Is that an honor?
I think it is, yes. And I can't ignore it, so I participate and I make use of the character in introductory remarks that bring a chuckle, especially from young people. So it's useful in that way.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
Buzz Aldrin talking to Stephen Moss. And you can hear more on the Apollo 11 mission today on this week's Science Weekly podcast. That's at guardian.co.uk/science. Chris Anderson is the editor of Wired. His first book was called The Long Tail. That gave a name to the ability of internet companies like Amazon to sell a large number of different items, a small quantity of each one. Well, his latest book is called Free, The Future of a Radical Price. It comes from the observation that giving stuff away free of charge is becoming more common because of new technology. He spoke to our technology editor, Charles Arthur.
Free is a word that we're super familiar with, and also the more you think about it, sort of the more confusing it is. Free has different meanings. You know, free as in liberty, freedom, free as in no price. And then free has this different economic meaning as well, which is sort of a trick, a marketing trick. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You get what you pay for. And then, strangely, it's turned into sort of the default economic model of the internet age. And so I thought we ought to have an economic theory to explain how free can be the default price for everything online. And that was the beginning of the book.
The thinking behind your book, your whole thesis, because you've worked very hard on it for quite a long time, is that with the internet especially, the cost of reproduction is effectively zero. Ideas don't know national boundaries. Things can spread. They can be multiplied. That the cost of getting an idea from one place to another goes to zero. The cost of getting a video from one place to another is near enough zero that the difference doesn't make much effect. What sort of economic impact does that then have on people making video, people consuming video, people who are in between? What are the ways those fit together?
I mean, the main effect has been you get a lot more of everything. I mean, you know, the old model was that everything needed a business model to get out there. So, you know, only professional media got through the scarce distribution channels of the 20th century, radio, television, print, etc. So everything was, all sort of mass content was professional content and satisfied a professional lens as to what content should be.
And there was a big cost barrier in actually getting out through that.
A very big cost barrier and also a kind of a credential barrier. You needed to have gotten into the professional media organizations to get your stuff out there. What free did, and by free I mean sort of, again, both liberty and no cost, what opening the tools of production to everybody did is got a lot of stuff out of there, including a lot of stuff that would not have otherwise passed the professional media test. And so the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the blogging and the Twittering, et cetera, is essentially, you know, sharing the distribution channels of media with professional media and presenting a huge amount of competition. And more to the point, a lot of content that we didn't think people wanted, but in fact it's proving they do want, both very narrow stuff, amateur stuff, grassroots, you know, I mean, all the kind of, you know, the viral stuff that's going online is by and large stuff that that we, the professional media companies, missed. We didn't realize there was a market for it, and even if we did realize there was a market for it, we didn't know how to produce it on the scale necessary to get those hits.
So media then, the sort of the traditional media, so to speak, is that threatened by this enormous growth in content, or is it something that it can use? Is there a way to, in effect, make money from free?
And that is, in fact, what the book is about. I mean, the observation that information wants to be free is now coming up 30 years old. The observation that the underlying economics of digital distribution allows things to be free is also decades old. What we're getting smart about is how to make money from free. The idea of making money from free is also 100 years old. That's called advertising, right? So the media business model, radio is free to air. Television is free to air. Our websites are traditionally free. There are many free newspapers. The idea that you can use...
Not exactly true in the UK because we have the BBC license fee, for example.
Unique to the UK. But in the US, all of our radio is free to air and it's advertising supported. And our television is all broadcast free. You can pay for cable, but it's broadcast for free. And it's all supported by a third party, the advertiser. And in economics, that's called a two-sided market, and one party subsidizes the other, and that's fine. The first wave of the internet was simply applying the media model, just slap advertising against things and hope that that'll pay the way. Then we got as smart, and we invented a new form of advertising with Google, and that became a better way of slapping ads against things, and it worked really well for Google, but didn't really work that well for anybody else. And now we're having to invent a new way of making money from free, and that's called freemium. And it's not new either, but people are getting much smarter about it. And freemium is free plus premium, where you have a free version and a premium version. You give away the free version to 80%, 90% of your audience, and then you convert maybe 10 or 20% to paid users. And that is that's where all the really interesting innovation is happening. A lot in the games world, but in software, as software becomes a service, you're seeing freemium become the default model. And I think that may be the future of media as well.
Chris Anderson, and Free, The Future of a Radical Price, is published by Random House. And there's more from Chris Anderson and Charles Arthur in this week's Tech Weekly podcast, guardian.co.uk/technology. Roxanne Escobales and Francesca Panetta produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.